It's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. It's Sydney Niemeyer, Making Connections, a Source of Wonder and Joy. Welcome, Sydney.
Well, the conference theme of science and technology as worship inspired me to think of the first time when I felt a deep sense of awe in my pursuit of science as a career. It actually happened during my first year at Calvin College. And in my first physics exam, I went totally blank on one problem. And for some reason that I still don't understand, the chair of the department then invited me to meet with him and decided I should do an accelerated independent study. So I had the opportunity to kind of go at my own pace through these two courses in one semester. And I got totally enthralled with the field of electricity and magnetism. In fact, I kind of just ignored the rest of my classes and just dove in and completed that course in about 3 weeks. And if you have physics, you might know that, you know, the basic equations are Maxwell's equations. It's shown here. I don't expect you to remember those. But it just was a magnificent thing. These equations that describe classical electricity and magnetism, became enthralled with them. One person wrote, "All equations of physics that serve to correlate experiments in a vast area and to predict new results have a certain beauty about them and can be appreciated by those who understand them on an aesthetic level." And don't worry, I'm not going to try to present to you why these are so beautiful. In a book written 100 years later, Edward Purcell wrote, and this is on the slide, "To anyone who's motivated by anything beyond the most narrowly practical, it's worthwhile to understand Maxwell's equations simply for the good of his soul."
Amen.
quite poetic for a physicist, I would say. But these equations are not just beautiful. They prove to be enormously practical. Almost all of our electromagnetic devices come out of Maxwell's equations. Now, I want to note that you have a couple constants here, and you can't really see them, but you have this small one right here. It's the permittivity constant, and it gets a value that makes this equation actually work in the real world. And then you have this other constant down here, the permeability constant, and that, again, helps to describe the real world. Well, coming upon this table, though, did not evoke my deep sense of awe and wonder. That came near the end of the class. So the textbook starts to describe how Maxwell's equations are applied in various circumstances, and one of those was a plane wave traveling in space. And so you show how Maxwell's equations can describe that. And this is the page that evoked my stunned sense of awe and wonder. So this equation, you don't really have to understand, but it's basically the equation of a traveling wave. You can reorganize it and derive what's the speed of that wave. The speed of that wave is given by those two constants. And amazingly, it predicts the speed of light. That was so stunning to me. Here I'm studying electricity and how it, you know, creates magnetic fields, and changing magnetic fields creates electric field. But out of this comes a prediction. People did not know at that time that light was actually an electromagnetic wave. Maxwell's equations predicted it. Yeah. And to an amazingly high degree, this prediction of the speed of light is true. I was stunned. It was a surprise. I think the fact that I went through it so fast kind of made more of an impression upon me. The book says the emergence of the speed of light from purely electromagnetic considerations is a crowning achievement of Maxwell's equations. You may not be able to read it. Here it is, and it says, which is the special, is the speed of light in free space, exclamation point. I wouldn't be surprised if it's the only exclamation point in the 1,200 pages of this textbook, although I didn't bother to verify that. In Scripture, we're given accounts of people who encounter the divine. It may be God or angels. And the reaction is almost always the same. They're fearful, but they're stunned by the presence. I was stunned when I came across this. I didn't literally fall to my knees, but I knelt in wonder in my spirit about this magnificent creation that God has given us that gives us such things as Maxwell's equations. Don't worry, that's the last of physics in my presentation. Well, I'm presenting, I'm going to kind of give you some other personal moments that impressed upon me with this theme of our conference, in a hope that it might inspire some of your own memories of when you had similar experiences. And I thought about what was the time in my research career when I felt the deepest sense of excitement. And so I want to describe that a little bit. My original field of research was in cosmochemistry. That's the study of the origin of the solar system by studying meteorites and lunar samples. And I loved this field of research. And I had the opportunity, and you know, these things kind of come about without knowing it's going to happen. But the original, when I entered the field in the 70s, the belief was that the solar nebula was hot and then things started to condense out of it. And the earliest condensates were believed to be these calcium aluminum-rich inclusions. It's these irregular white objects that you might see in this sample of a meteorite, calcium aluminum-rich inclusions. And those are the objects I studied to discover these isotopic anomalies. Because we believe that the whole solar system was isotopically homogenized, but we found a different composition in these objects. By the way, these small round things are the chondrules. That's how the chondrites get their name, because chondrules are so abundant, and they're the most primitive meteorites that we have. And then the black background is what we call the matrix. When I got to Lawrence Livermore, I just made that discovery as a postdoc, and then I continued to develop and do more measurements on more materials. I then tried to gather everything together in a paper I wrote in 1988 and tried to push as hard as I can. These are very, very small deviations. I show here, there's a slide from the talk. These are the isotopic variations in epsilon units, which are parts per 10,000. So for these whole rock samples, the average is about 3 epsilon units or 0.03%. So you need to make very accurate measurements. So I take these very, very small differences, and I just pushed as hard as I can. What does this tell me about how the early solar system evolved in terms of the dust component? And what happened is I began to get an idea that these results were telling me something quite different than what we believed at that time. And I pushed hard in my interpretation, probably went beyond what I should have, but I came up with a very different point of view, that these high-temperature condensates weren't actually condensates. That all these objects, the CAIs and the chondrules and the matrix, all were very similar in their precursor assemblages, and you created these inclusions by heating them up to a degree where you have partial melting, lost some material, and that's what gave the isotopic difference for the rest of the solar system. So I pushed hard on that idea, and it just filled me with such excitement over about the 6 weeks that I wrote this paper that I was discovering a possible new insight to how the solar system was formed. Several years later, I took the position of a division leader, and my active research career in the laboratory finished, and I didn't follow this field anymore. But recently, a young researcher at the same lab, Lawrence Livermore, young compared to me, told me that this result is still highly relevant and widely cited, and I had no idea, but it was nice of him to tell me that. Well, when I became a division leader, my division was in crisis. The main job of my nuclear chemistry division was the nuclear weapons testing program. That's where we got most of our funding. 3 months after I became a division leader, the testing moratorium came, and that funding promptly dwindled, which thrust me into the role of program development. What could this diverse mix of scientists contribute to now? And I also had to change the culture of the division to become more proactive. Well, a year before I became division leader, Hans Mark, who was formerly a secretary of the Air Force, came and gave a talk at the laboratory. And he presented this question: how quickly and with what certainty, if any, could we identify the origin of a nuclear weapon unclaimed by anyone? This is a question we had not considered before. During the Cold War, that wasn't the focus. But now we're in the post-Cold War. And this suddenly started to emerge, not for most people. Washington kind of moves slowly in the problems it's focused on. So I began to give talks, one or two a month, to different groups about defining how we should approach this problem. What are the kinds of things we should do? By the way, my background as cosmochemistry really equipped me for doing this work. You can think of cosmochemistry as a type of cosmic forensics. You think of it, you have a meteorite, a rock that fell out of the sky, and you pick it up and say, okay, let's do all the measurements we can on this rock to tell us what happened 4.6 billion years ago. And so it's different than the usual thing that a physicist does, but it gave me the mindset to address this new problem. You need a multidisciplinary approach, and you need to think about how you can intuit the history of a material. So we recognize that there's various applications, both before and after an explosion, and also the nuclear materials themselves. Another thing that distinguishes this field is you don't just work with other scientists. You have to work very intimately with law enforcement, intelligence, and sometimes political types as well. I actually retired early from the laboratory in order to accept a full-time role at my local church as their executive pastor. So in 2007, I did more work kind of in the policy arena before I departed from the laboratory and did a number of talks and appeared a number of places. And one of the things we did was to write an article for this Arms Control Today and to make the case that nuclear forensics was important before the bomb goes off. All the discussion up to that time in the public was focused on what do we do after a detonation. And we made the point that it's really important to analyze every case until we're sure it doesn't point to something much more serious that's going to happen. In fact, the only clue we might get that something really bad is about to happen is some material showing up someplace where it shouldn't be. So we wrote that article. 12 years later, when I retired as a pastor, I realized this field of nuclear forensics, I imagine maybe none of you have ever heard of it, wasn't very well known. So I decided I'm going to try and get this out more into the public arena, and I'm going to do that by writing a thriller. So imagine, it's a little bit different than a scientist writing a scientific article or even writing a sermon. So basically what I did is I took the key point I made in that article and embedded it in a story. And if it involves a terrorist bringing a nuclear bomb to the U.S., it kind of has to be a thriller. So I set about doing that. Really, my goal here was to educate while I was entertaining. And so I wrote it in such a way that technical people could appreciate it, but non-technical people could follow the logic flow. So if you want to judge whether I succeeded in writing an entertaining story, you might consider. I actually have a few copies of the book. If you would like, you can pick one up afterwards, only under the condition that you agree that you're going to actually read it and discover for yourself whether I was able to write an engaging story. Well, I want to highlight one. I'm going to skip that slide. There's another element that connects science and worship. So that's the theme, science as worship. And that is that element of beauty. And this is a rather, we kind of know it, but I just wanted to bring it out because it's kind of a rather surprising connection. Now, we have a lot of songs in which we praise God for his beauty. I just gave an example of some worship songs that have that in the title. But we also see it in science. Beauty has often proved to be a guide, to an intuition for the scientists that somehow our theories ought to strike us as beautiful. It's amazing. Oftentimes, the beauty comes because the theory is elegant. There's a certain degree of simplicity about it. And symmetry often plays a role as well. And scientists have often evoked this sense of, if it doesn't strike me as beautiful, maybe it's not correct. Such a surprising connection, isn't it? But maybe it's not surprising for us at ASA, because we know the ultimate source of both beauty and truth is God. But for the non-Christian, for the non-believer, that has to be a rather strange thing, that theories that strike us as beautiful are somehow also true. But I want to come to the final part about, you know, again, my theme is making connections. And that in making these connections, like in nuclear forensics, it's the connection between the material characteristics and its history. Or in the meteorite research, it's making connections between what we can measure in a rock and what happened in the solar nebula 4.6 billion years ago. But the most profound way we experience a sense of wonder and joy in making connections is in our interpersonal relationships. And we know that from our everyday walk in life. Yes, we get a profound sense often of joy and excitement in our scientific work, but it's the interpersonal relationships that create the most sense of joy and wonder. Here, I just want to comment a little bit on this field of interpersonal neurobiology. Of course, I'm not an expert. I've just read about it. A couple of the people that have especially influenced me are Kurt Thompson, who's a Christian psychiatrist. Jim Wilder has been talking and writing about this for decades. He also calls himself a neurotheologian. Now, neurobiologists are discovering that the ways in which we interact with other people actually changes our brain. Our brain physically changes by the way we interact with others, for good or for ill. Our neural development depends on the way that we engage in attuned relationships with others. And he repeatedly makes this point that our brains were designed, and we know by God, to engage in relationship with God and other people. We're literally wired to connect. When we connect with another person, it makes new connections in our brains. And this has a profound impact on how we view our spiritual growth. And that's what these authors are especially teasing out. How is it the discoveries in neurobiology change the way we think and approach discipleship or spiritual growth? I think that Kurt Thompson, his book, Anatomy of a Soul, I think one of his lasting contributions in that is he makes the point that our spiritual growth isn't kind of just a metaphorical thing. It actually relates to measurable changes in our brain function and structure. In his later book, his third book was called Soul of Desire, and it comes back to this theme of beauty, that beauty is related in some ways to the way our brains function. He makes the point that our desire to be known manifests itself in our need to create and experience beauty. And I won't have time to go through it, but he says that beauty serves multiple functions in our human experience. Beauty, and the talk that we had in the just before lunch teases out so wonderfully. Beauty reveals something about God's character. After all, he's the master artist. Beauty is a form in which God communicates to us. Encountering beauty changes us at neurobiological levels, and it's part of our transformation. When we experience beauty, and this is what I tried to convey in my first example, when we experience something beautiful in our scientific research, it motivates us to further discovery in our scientific research. And then the final point I want to make is it's the connection. The beauty in our connection with others builds community. And that's true of both scientific and Christian communities. In ASA, we have both. We both have ourselves as a multidisciplinary scientific organization and a Christian community. I want to finish, though, with the most profound sense of connection, and that is our identity. Identity answers the question of, who am I? I think this is the most important question of our life. And identity just doesn't come out of something we create within ourselves. Identity basically is formed through our relationships. And so if somebody asks, who am I? We might answer, you know, something about our family of origin, our current family, or the career that we have, or some of our achievements. But we know that's not the most profound element of answering this question, who am I? A big part of my spiritual journey in the last two decades is answering this question by saying this: I'm a beloved child of God in whom the Father delights. This is really the most personal part of my talk. That delight was important. 20 years ago, I believed all my life God loves me. But if you ask me, does the Father delight in me? I go, that can't be true. He told me something. I believed that God loved me. But I think the most important part in our spiritual growth is to experience the reality of God's love for us, that he actually delights in us. It's experiencing God's love that I believe is the foundation of our spiritual growth. As scientists, we grasp more deeply than most the magnificent beauty of God's creation. But neurobiology can be summarized this way. I had a slide earlier, but I didn't say it. That we all come into this world as infants, looking for somebody, looking for us. An infant's trying to make sense of this world they just arrived in, but God created us in such a way that we're looking naturally for somebody who's looking for us. And what we discover to be true is the somebody ultimately who comes looking for us is the magnificent creator of this world. He was looking for us from the very beginning. We didn't know it then. But as we grow older and we open our hearts and turn to Him, He turns to us and says, "You are my beloved child in whom I delight." And that is the ultimate source of our wonder and joy.
A few minutes for questions, brief questions. Yes.
So I like the way you put relationship in there. Clearly, at the very beginning, Maxwell had relationship. The electricity is defined in relation to magnetism. And in the end, your identity is formed in relationship.
Right.
I like the way you put that together.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, Sydney, thank you for the inspiring talk. I wonder what applications would you think would be appropriate, maybe for some of us in ASA, regarding arms control, because we have lost all the disarmament treaties at this point, except for one which will expire next year. How can we help to resolve this situation?
We're called to be peacemakers, aren't we? And I'm in the ironic position of, working at a nuclear weapons laboratory. How does this contribute? In fact, the first ASA meeting that I attended was in 88 or 89. I spoke about, is there hope for one who works at a nuclear weapons lab? But I see primarily what we're doing, it comes back to this element of deterrence. We can't do away with the reality of nuclear weapons. The physics is out there. It's pretty easy. Technologically, there's about barriers. But some of us, at least, are called to make contributions towards having these weapons never be used again. And that's partly what motivated me. I think it fit, but what motivated me back in the early 90s to push ahead with developing this field of nuclear forensics, because I thought it had to be an important part of nuclear deterrence in the future. So some of us are called to that. But there is this irony, this paradox that you often have, especially when it comes to nuclear weapons. But my goal in all of my research and the programs I led at the laboratory was to do the kinds of things that would keep these weapons from ever being used. In my novel, I make that a central principle or objective of the hero of the story. That's what he was about.
Yeah. Thank you. So this was a really good talk and overwhelm of wonder in the real time when we hear. I was curious about this concept of beauty, and I think when it comes to science, at least in the context of the conference so far, I've been kind of really just delighted with the images and the discussions about the natural sciences, and you see the DNA, protein interactions, and the cross sections, but it's a little bit different when it comes to equations.
Yeah.
And I'm a data scientist and epidemiologist, and I think sometimes I can have trouble finding the wonder in the data, the numbers, the equations.
Yeah.
So I want to hear more of your thoughts on looking for the beauty in that space and how better to open my own eyes to see it there.
Ooh. One of the reflections I have, especially when I was a research scientist working in the lab, a lot of our science isn't full of work. Our work is not wonder and joy, right? It's grindingly routine work. I had to learn how to do chemical separations, even though I'm a physicist. I'm pouring, liquids through columns and stuff like that. It's a lot of hard work. But what you see is the motivation by the moments we have when we glimpse these new discoveries that drives us through that very hard work. And I think that really applies in our personal lives, too. A lot of relationships are kind of boring or hard stuff to do, but there's moments when it's just so transcendently wonderful. And so you have that same kind of thing, I think, happening in our work as a scientist. A lot of it is deadly dull. A lot of it's very frustrating, especially when you get involved in the policy community like I was. Oh, my goodness. Working with the White House and trying to develop a new organization, oh, that was painful. But partly, and it's not your answer, but maybe a previous answer, I was motivated to do it. I didn't know how God was going to use it. Sometimes it seems so useless trying to work with the White House and National Security Council. So frustrating, but I felt God had me there for a reason and to keep forging on and see what happens.
One quick question. Quick.
This is a question on the other side of the spectrum when it comes to beauty and the equations. How about when beauty leads us astray, like, especially in physics? Like, look at an equation and call it beautiful usually when it's symmetric. Or even like, say, the orbit of the Earth. Like, it would be so nice if it was a circle, but it's not. It would be so nice if the Earth was a sphere, but it's had a bulge. Like, so certain equations, like, it would be so nice if they were so symmetric, but there's kind of some epsilon factor that kind of makes it straight. Like, the theorists sort of really preferred it if it was just a beautiful symmetric version, but the experimentalists find it the other way around, the observer. So,
right.
In those instances, does it lead us to change our understanding of beauty?
And I didn't make this comment, I was included in a longer version of this talk, but yeah, beauty can be a guide, but ultimately it has to reflect reality. So we get the balance there. I did read that Kepler actually changed from the circular orbits to the elliptical orbits because he thought it was actually more beautiful. That was part of his motivation. It turned out to be true. So the way we perceive beauty is sometimes in the eye of the beholder. So it is a guide, and there's something about that. But yes, we have to recognize it's a guide only, and we ultimately have to come back to the empirical truth.
Before we thank Sidney for his talk, let me remind you, only take one of his copies of his book if you're going to read it. Let's thank Sidney one more time.
Thank you.